We are the people of God who wear his name, and again, actually for a second time tonight in one passage, we'll be seeing an illustration by way of a parable now of the influence that we have, the power that we have, the important roles that each and every one of us play in the plans of God, you know, here in this place and in our time, as so many have before us. A great cloud of witnesses that has gone ahead, according to Hebrews chapter 12. We are a part of that pantheon while we live and look to be a part of it, of course, eternally as well. Going to be starting the parables, as you probably know. I've been advertising that for a little bit now. And so tonight will be our first lesson in that regard. The photograph that you see, the slide, title slide here this evening, not directly related, but it is of a location in Jerusalem, a place, of course, where Jesus spoke some of these parables. This particular structure you see at the bottom is called the Citadel of David. That is an absolutely terrible name for it. It has nothing to do with David. It was built 1,000 years after David, 2,000 years after David lived, by the Muslims, about 1500. But it is built upon the foundations from the time of Herod the Great, his original construction of Jerusalem itself. It's a fascinating location. It's a museum now, and one of the better ones, I thought, in Israel. So throughout all of these corridors and various rooms that are hidden around here are museum areas telling the history, story of the Jews, the biblical history. Fascinating. Now, also, though, if you look down here in these little chairs, I was terribly disappointed for Susan's sake and for Emma's sake when we were here just recently. The year before, in 2017, I had attended a light show that they've been putting on for years, really world-renowned, and for good reason. Every night at 10 o'clock, they have, again, the history of Israel, but you come in and you fill these seats and along these balconies here and much more that are behind you as you'd be looking at this picture, behind the person taking the picture. And then every service that you see comes alive, all of it, put up even this Islamic tower. And they just use the biblical history to take you from creation all the way through Abraham, various battles, the destruction of the city under Nebuchadnezzar, something we'll be looking at very shortly as a result of the parable study. And so it's just a marvel to behold, really a sophisticated presentation, video that appears on every stone surface as a part, as if it were a screen, but using the very stones, too, kind of implementing it. So I just want to rub that in. Now, Susan, tough luck. You didn't get to see how great it was. So go again next year, right? Whoever else can't join us. I'm already thinking about going again a year from October, sometime around October of 2019. So come and join me. Okay, I think at the outset here, though, as we turn directly to the parables, virtually everyone in this room is familiar, at least, with the etymology, the derivation of the word itself. Now, this is the Greek word for parable, parabolein, in this particular form. Greek words add endings to help you understand the usage of a given word in a sentence. Para means alongside or beside, and then the bolein part comes from the word that means to throw something or to cast something. It has to do with the idea of placing it. And so, to cast alongside or to place alongside, to put alongside, to throw alongside, the whole point of the word is to say, we've got this idea, and then we're going to put a story beside it. And this story is going to do something for us, depending on the type of mindset that you have. This story will either help or, as a matter of fact, hinder you in understanding what it was that Jesus preeminently was talking about. So this next definition, I didn't derive from somebody else's dictionary or whatever. I created this one myself. But what a parable is it is a short story, or I use the word illustration because often enough, it is so short that you wouldn't even really think of it as being a story. The very first ones you'll see are like this. But a short story or a very brief illustration that is drawn, and this is critically important, from events that are known to be true. Now, just for a moment, I want to draw us all up to think about this. In a parable, whatever the story is that is cast alongside this truth that's being illustrated. The thing that you're going to be hearing about, the story, the illustration, represents something that is true, that happens in the real world lives of the hearer. And then it is set alongside so as to eliminate, or as you'll see in the next verse, actually to conceal a lesson. Now the reason I make so much out of that second line though, drawn from this known to be true, is because some might argue even the most difficult passage in all the New Testament, not even in Revelation this time, is Luke 16. In Luke 16, two people die, a rich man and Lazarus. And one goes one way and the other goes the other way. There has been in recent years a rather new and unique interpretation of what Jesus was talking about. Question is, did that even actually happen? Was there a man named Lazarus who died, or is this a parable? And then there is this new twist where people are saying, this is the only parable where the event never happened and never will. And it is then a parable that Jesus is using of a thing that is false that was believed by the Jews. And Jesus is now using their false understanding as the basis of a story to try to illustrate something. And I feel very strongly that that is not the case. It's pretty important to recognize when you have a parable, it's the story itself, what is cast alongside this spiritual lesson, is true. It's a thing that people have observed. It's a thing that they understand. It's not a lie. You don't use something that is false. But what intrigues me here is that these parables have this twofold and nearly opposite purpose: to illuminate or to conceal. This we derive from Matthew chapter 13. I'm going to go, John read a portion of this. We're going to expand on that now. I wanted him to read it, so you could get it under your belt twice this evening. Come to Matthew in chapter 13. And in the 13th chapter of this great book of Matthew, which particularly features parables, more so than the other Gospels, in the 13th chapter we have this conversation taking place beginning at verse 10. The disciples came and said to him, so we have some followers of Jesus, some believers, some eager people who have accepted what Jesus is teaching, but they don't understand these parables. So they say, why do you speak to them in parables? You're presenting these stories clearly as related to some principle or concept or lesson that you're trying to impart. But why do you do that? Because they see some of the confusion that arises. And so he answered and said to them, to you, these disciples, inner circle, close to Jesus, people who understand, to you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. But to them it has not been granted. For whoever has, to him shall more be given. Please note, we're not told here what they have. We don't know what thing it is that they have. But whoever has, fill in the blank, he doesn't define it for us. To him shall more of this undefined thing be given, and he shall have an abundance. So you'll get a whole lot of what he's not telling us what he's talking about. But whoever does not have, even what he has shall be taken away from him. Therefore, so this is why I speak to them, not you, to you it's been given to understand, but I speak to them in parables, because while seeing, they do not see. And while hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. And in their case, he's establishing two cases, same parable, two totally different responses, two different types of people. So in their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, you will keep on hearing, but will not understand. You will keep on seeing, but will not perceive. For the heart of this people has become dull. With their ears they scarcely hear. They've closed their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes, hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and return, and I should heal them. But blessed are your eyes, back and forth between the two groups of people, between those to whom it has been granted to understand, those disciples, and to those who it has not. Why are you speaking to them in parables? Well, he's speaking to both groups in parables. Now he says in 16, blessed are your eyes because they see, and your ears because they hear. For truly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not, and to hear what you hear and did not hear. Hear then the parable of the sower. And we're not going to deal with the parable of the sower tonight. But do you notice what just happened there? The disciples come up. Why do you speak to them in parables? Let's read between the lines a little bit. Do they understand the parable of the sower that Jesus has already spoken of in the earlier part of this chapter? You know the story. The sower went out to sow four seeds, different soils. He had already uttered all that. And then when he did, the disciples came up and said, why do you talk to them about that? Before you get to verse 18, what does Jesus proceed to do? Explain to them what clearly they do not understand. They didn't understand it any better than the other group did. So what's happening? Jesus says, okay, I'll tell you why I use parables. I use parables. Now, this is the grossest paraphrase you ever heard in your life. What he says is, I use parables because they're like a sifter. They separate people. There are people who can learn, who want to learn, who will learn, and it is given to them to understand. And you're among them. So, you heard the parable, and you didn't understand it. Now I'm going to explain it to you, and you will. It has been given to you to understand, so I'll give you not only the parable, but also its interpretation. But to them, I give them the parable, and did they line up and say, Lord, what's that thing mean? Why did you tell us that story? No, the others didn't. They just shook their heads, scratched them, and walked away apparently. To whom was it given to understand the parable? To the ones that passed the test. To the ones that were so refined that they could get through the screen and the filtration process. To the ones that got over the hurdle and made the effort and demonstrated, we really do want to know. We really will pay a higher price. If we don't understand right on the surface easily, then we'll expend time and energy and we'll pursue you, Jesus, to find out. We hunger and thirst after righteousness. They don't. And Jesus put the parable out there. He threw that parable out there to separate these two groups of people. If you're unwilling, if you choose not to put in the effort, then you'll quit when you say, well, I don't get that. It must be his fault. He's a bad teacher. Bye-bye. But that's not what happened with the disciples. Why did you do that? Why did you say that? We don't understand it. Well, to you it has been given to understand. So now let me tell you. Now, brethren, in a lot of these parables, you can understand both the words that were thrown out there and the principle, the concept, the lesson that they help to illustrate. But whether or not you live in the time of Christ, when a parable gets tossed out, you should immediately, remembering this passage as a foundation for all parables, recognize this is not necessarily easy stuff. This is not necessarily something that just will instantly make itself clear. If I'm looking at a parable, I better be awfully careful to ensure and confirm that I really have an honest heart that puts forth the effort and walks that extra mile to find out the truth. I am a truth seeker. In this passage, we are taught that's a primary function for parables, to separate those truth seekers from those who are not. Now, you may come to understand that parable right off the bat. Some are easy, some clearly, you know, you can see what it is. But always you want to scratch your head and say, is there more to understand there? Then you go and you study your Bible. You find other passages. You put it together. And eventually, you know, that picture is going to take place. So it may immediately illuminate some lesson, some spiritual truth. Or it might hide it to find out if you'll rise up and say, I'll pursue it. I'll chase it. Pity the poor hunter who says, if I can't bag my game off the front porch, well, then I guess I won't have any. If you're going to go hunting, then what do you have to do? Go and hunt. The scriptures are like that. We find this principle everywhere, brethren. God expects us to expend some energy, expects us to put in some time. He's expecting us to get busy and hunt after that truth because some things are difficult and it takes a while for you to develop the skills and the talents and the time, put in the time to understand them. Okay, so enough on that for just a second now. Let's think about Old Testament occurrences. To my surprise, and only because I was working, at the request of the elders on this material, I hadn't really ever even thought about parables in the Old Testament. We just associate those with Jesus. Jesus told parables. You don't even see them in the apostles. Jesus told parables. You know, they're the parables of Jesus. Well, not entirely. The Ezekiel's 17th chapter is given over, all of it, to a parable. So please come back now to Ezekiel and see that God has been doing the same thing in the Old Testament as well. Now, it is an entire chapter, and so obviously 24 verses. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I do want to hit just two high points very quickly here. So if you come back to Ezekiel 17, you look at verse 1, it says, the word of Yahweh came to me saying, son of man, propound a riddle and speak a parable to the house of Israel. Now, brethren, this is pretty certain here, and this is very common in the way that the Hebrews thought and spoke frequently. It's just the heart of the Psalms, for instance, and Proverbs, is that you have the two statements made that are the same idea right next to each other. Pardon me momentarily. And you have these two statements that are made in altogether different words, but they mean the same thing. So when he says, propound a riddle and speak a parable, both of those expressions are talking about the very same thing that he's about to say. Ezekiel in the 17th chapter is not going to say, okay, here's the riddle, and then say, all right, I'm done with that now, so now let's go have the parable, and I'll present a parable to you. It's not that at all. Everything that follows in this 17th chapter is a riddle and a parable. Now, brother, what is a riddle? The whole point of a riddle. Somebody presents you with a riddle. What do they expect you to do? Solve a puzzle. They expect you to go to work to uncover what has purposely been concealed. Riddles, though, are fun. Most people kind of enjoy them. The most famous, the most popular of all riddles, I suppose, in our culture today is, what have I got in my pocket? I know only those that chuckle have been reading after Tolkien or watching the Lord of the Rings movies, and you can see, Bilbo down there in the cave with Gollum. What have I got in my pocket? Well, the truth is that's not a riddle at all. I don't know how Tolkien even got away with that. A riddle is something more than that. A riddle is solvable. What have I got in my pocket is a guess. It's not a riddle at all. That's not fair. If you've read the book, Hobbit, some of these other things, that were proposed between the two, Gollum and Bilbo there, they were riddles. But this is not. A riddle focuses attention, captures the mind, causes you to start processing at your highest possible level. Take clues, assemble them, and then find out what the answer to the mystery is. And in this statement, that is your definition of a parable. So first we have to kind of disabuse ourselves, I guess, of the idea, well, parables are just illustrations to help you understand. No, they are simultaneously also riddles to see if you care. God isn't going to just give it away. You're going to have to count the cost and then pay it to understand these things. So, Son of Man, propound a riddle and speak a parable of the house of Israel, saying, thus says the Lord Yahweh, a great eagle with great wings, long pinions, and full plumage of many colors came to Lebanon and took away the top of the cedar. He plucked off the topmost of its young twigs and brought it to a land of merchants. He set it in a city of traders. He also took some of the seed of the land and planted it in fertile soil. He placed it beside abundant waters. He set it like a willow. Then it sprouted and became a low-spreading vine with its branches turned toward him, but its roots remained under it, so it became a vine. It yielded shoots and sent out branches. Then there was another great eagle with great wings. See, and I'm not going to read the rest of it. Now, everything we've read so far, do eagles exist? Yes. Are some eagles bigger, greater? Yes. Do some have more color, plumage, you know, and so it kind of stands out? Yes. Do they sometimes go and pluck branches? Well, sure, they build nests out of them. Do they sometimes rather inadvertently plant seeds? Why is it that you will find blackberry bushes all along the telephone power lines? And y'all laugh because y'all know that's where the birds poop. And that's how they plant their seeds. So they eat the berries, the seeds, then they fly with them, away with them, you know, and then they all line up, you know, and when they poop, out come seeds, they get planted. Here we go. So everything that's in this story, people, you know, have seen, they identify it, they recognize it. Now please come over to now verse 11. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me saying, say now to the rebellious house, do you not know what these things mean? Well, what had he just propounded? A riddle. A parable. Do you know what it means? Say, now Son of Man, which is Ezekiel, say, behold, the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem, took its king and princes, and brought them to him in Babylon. That's what the first part of that riddle was about. And he took one of the royal family, made a covenant with him, putting him under oath. He also took away the mighty of the land, that the kingdom might be in subjection, not exalting itself, and keeping his covenant that it might continue. But he rebelled against him by sending his envoys to Egypt, that they might give him horses and many troops. Will he succeed? Will he who does such things escape? Can he break the covenant and escape? The answer is no. Now, brother, I'll submit to you that without Ezekiel's interpretation, nobody on the planet could understand that parable. It doesn't illuminate a truth unless you have a prophet to tell you what it represents in this case. So if you want to know what the answer to that riddle is, you've got to show some fortitude, some devotion. You've got to show some intense commitment. You've got to go seek out the prophet. You don't find out. Well, in this case, he's just revealing it in the chapter. But we find out the eagle represents the king of Babylon. And then, by the way, if you want to make a note, just while you're here, we're not studying this book, but in verse 15, that's Zedekiah. Zedekiah, verse 15, did this very thing, sought help from Egypt in 588 B.C. And it failed. And then the temple and the whole city was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar 2 years later in 586 B.C. This is quite a foretelling of the future. It's a prophecy as well as a riddle and a parable. It was cast alongside the foretelling of a historical event that was 2 years away to get these people to wake up, to think, to study, to ask, to come and beseech the prophet then, you know, to explain such things. Now, I'm wondering and suspecting that, you know, Son of Man, go do this, and he did. And then now, after the fact, he's recording it. So that interpretation, we read them right next to each other in the book. But when Ezekiel was preaching, that isn't the way it worked. He went around telling this story. And would that not just separate all human beings into two camps? One camp would say, nutcase, I'm going to go buy a lemon meringue pie. And the other one says, that's a prophet.
And there's something in there that I just can't sleep tonight before I find out what he's talking about. What does that eagle represent? What does that cedar in Lebanon represent? What is this all about? And then Ezekiel would write down later the interpretation, but he's likely writing it down after we have the event of that fall of Jerusalem. There's Ezekiel 17. In a like manner, if you turn a few pages, we'll get to chapter 24. And brethren, oddly enough, though, to my knowledge, these are the only parables in our Old Testament. This one's much smaller. Chapter 24, verse 1, the word of the Lord came to me in the ninth year, the tenth month, tenth of the month, saying, Son of man, write the name of the day, this very day. King of Babylon has laid siege to Jerusalem this very day. Now, where's Ezekiel? Babylon, 1,000 miles away, I guess, hundreds. So, I'm revealing it to you, Ezekiel. Just now the siege started. This is 588 B.C. Now, 3, speak a parable to the rebellious house and say to them, thus says the Lord Yahweh, put on the pot, put it on, also pour water in it, put in it the pieces, every good piece, the thigh and the shoulder, so these are sacrifices that they'd be familiar with, fill it with choice bones, take the choicest of the flock, also pile wood under the pot, make it boil vigorously, seed its bones in it. Is this not something they did every day, both for food and for sacrifice? Well, yeah. So 6. Therefore, that's the end of your parable, that's the end of your riddle, therefore thus says the Lord Yahweh, woe to the bloody city, to the pot in which there's rust, whose rust has not gone out of it. Take out of it piece after piece without making a choice, for her blood is in her midst. She placed it on a bare rock. She did not pour it on the ground to cover it with dust. I'll stop. I'm not going to get into complexities. We're not studying Ezekiel. Brethren, the life is in the blood. You do not treat blood flippantly, negligently. So he describes this, but what were you supposed to do with the blood of a sacrifice? Pour it out. These people didn't. So here's their awful, abominable sacrifice. And today, Ezekiel, the siege began on those people 1,000 miles away in Jerusalem because they are sinful, because they do not respect what is holy, what is pure, and they will pay. This is the third time Nebuchadnezzar invades. After this siege, the temple will be torn down, every stone upon another. So, what are parables? They are simultaneously telling you a truth, in this case, foretelling the near future, 2 years away, the fall. Today, the siege began. And qualifying the people to see who has love for God, to see who cares, to see who will pursue the understanding of this truth when it takes time and effort. Now, we're still in our introductory material, so one more thing, and I have no idea what to do with this fact. So I just tell you what everybody notices. Why are there no classic-style parables in the Gospel of John? I don't know. Matthew records them. Mark records them. Luke records them. It is a major aspect of the teaching of Jesus. He was using it, the disciples have just learned in Matthew 13, to separate people into these two camps, so they're important. How come John is not led by the Spirit of God to record it in a single one of them? And we just are not going to know because God has not told us. Of course, he records a great deal that the other Gospels don't. He focuses more on the sermons, the preaching, the doctrines of Jesus, then he does the actions, and so he has a lot fewer miracles. There's only 7 in his whole book. Major differences in the Gospel of John. But there's just a fun fact for you, I guess. You know, there aren't any parables there. We're not going to be studying parables in John. Now, let's look at the first of the parables. And you might stumble over this a little bit, but I'll answer your question in just a minute. But the first of the parables is probably not the one you think that it is. And the shortest, apparently, so I said a little while ago again, doesn't need to be much of a story. But we're going to go chronologically. And chronologically, it's Luke 5. For you better Bible students, and as soon as I said the first of the parables, you went to what? Well, there's no telling.
but it's not what you might think. It's in Luke 5. So 33 through 39. I got to get the New Testament myself. Okay, in Luke chapter 5, in verse 33, which you'd think is a little bit later in the history too, four chapters gone by already, but in Luke 5, verse 33, they said to him, the disciples, these are detractors of Jesus, the disciples of John, that's the Baptist, often fast and offer prayers. Disciples of the Pharisees also do the same. But yours eat and drink. And Jesus said to them, you cannot make the attendants of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them, can you? Now, does everybody know what bridegrooms are in that culture and ours? Does everybody know who the attendants are? Has everybody been to a wedding? Is all this familiar? Does it happen in real life? Sure. You cannot make the attendants of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom's with them, can you? Well, certainly not. We call this a party. Not, you know, it's not a funeral. That's just inappropriate. 35. Days will come. And when the bridegroom is taken away from them, then they'll fast in those days. And he was telling them a parable. So the scripture identifies this as a parable. Parable number two, in fact. No one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. Otherwise, he'll both tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. You've all heard the story about shrinkage and all that, you know, so you understand it now. That'd be a mistake. It would mess up the garment. 37. And, so this is apparently our third parable, no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the new wine will burst the skins, and it'll be spilled out, and the skins will be ruined. Once again, everybody understand goats, understand skins, understand wine, understand a fermentation. It expands. If you got an older skin, it's already been stretched. You put the new wine in it. When the wine expands, it'll tear that thing to bits. It's going to blow it up. It hasn't got any more room to expand. You never do that. You don't put new wine into old wine skins. It'll burst the skins. 38. But new wine must be put into fresh wine skins. And no one, after drinking old wine, wishes for new, for he says the old's good enough. There's a fourth parable. Four teeny tiny little statements. Now, who wants to tell me what the answer to the riddle is? What would those people be thinking? They came and they said in 33, the disciples of John fast, offer prayers. Pharisees fast and offer prayers. Yours eat and drink. You're not into fasting. So he said, can't make the times attendance of the bridegroom fast while he's with them. And no one tears a piece from a new garment, puts it on an old. And you don't put new wine into old wineskins. And if you drink an old wine, you wouldn't ask for new. Did he answer their question? Absolutely. Did any of those hard-hearted, you know, men, some of whom be responsible for his murder another 2.5-3 years from now, do you suppose they really understood what he was saying? You'd go, huh? What? And brethren, that's exactly why he did that. He wanted to find out who would say, what, Lord? Why did you say that? Do you have any record of that? No. These guys came with a grudge. They didn't like Jesus already. They'd made up their minds. So how come your disciples fast? Jesus said, well, I'll tell you. It's got to do with wineskins and garments and bridegrooms. Now, if they cared, what would they figure out? Now, brethren, be careful, because you don't want to press a parable too far. There's a truth to be found,
But you'll find people make the most outlandish statements about this means that, and this means that, and every individual part. There are four statements there, and every one of them only says one thing, and they say exactly the same thing four times. Four times. As short as you can say it, how would you, you know, understand it? Here's the question. You cannot make the attendants of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom's with them. Can you? What's the answer? No. It would be inappropriate. Doesn't fit the circumstances. What Jesus is saying is, the reason I and my disciples do not fast is the same reason you don't put new wine in old wineskins. It's not appropriate. It won't work. It's the wrong time. He told them four times the same thing. They had their answer. But I wonder how many of them really got it. The answer is, I, Jesus, am the bridegroom. I'm here. It's time for joy. Not sorrow. Not fasting. But then he added, one day the bridegroom will be taken away. And then what? Then time for sorrow. But you have today. Now then, that one, by the way, this first of all parables, and so short, four of them in a row like that, are recorded in all three Gospels. When Jesus got going with parables, that's how he started it, and all three Gospels record it. Now, the Sermon on the Mount, we'll just go ahead and wrap this up quickly. Turn to Matthew chapter 5. It's curious to me that in Matthew chapter 5, we have the Sermon on the Mount's beginning early on, just shortly after the Beatitudes, and then some introductory information, but really at the start, verse 13 in chapter 5, you have a parable. So in effect, at least, the parable was right at the start. It's the beginning of the sermon. So in 5:13, you are the salt of the earth. I told you we'd be remembering something we just studied. If the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It's good for nothing anymore, except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Ye are the light of the world. City set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp and put it under the peck measure, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. So you're these three things. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Now salt is different than cities and different than the light you put on a lampstand. They're all three different. But is this an understandable thing? Salt, cities, and light have a purpose that should not be defeated. And that purpose is to impact, to influence, to be seen. And you're that. You're that salt. Don't be useless. We'll just throw you out and trample you. You're the light. Don't be useless. Put under a peck measure. That'd be ridiculous. You're the city. Don't be useless. Be up on a hill where everybody can see you. Three things that he said was just simply get busy and be serving me. Now come to Matthew 7. In Matthew 7, verses 24 through 27, having begun the Sermon on the Mount with this information about influencing other people, being a servant of God, you know, it's useful. Come to Matthew 7, verses 24 through 27, which is the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 7, verse 24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts upon them may be compared to a wise man who built his house upon the rock. Rain descended, floods came, winds blew, burst against the house. It did not fall, for it had been founded upon the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act upon them will be like a foolish man who built his house upon the sand. Rain descended, floods came, winds blew, burst against that house, it fell, great was its fall, and the result was, when he finished these words, multitudes were amazed. That includes the whole sermon. That's a parable. Understand houses, understand foundations, understand rocks, understand sand. Yeah, I get it. Okay, we've been doing that all our lives, building houses. Why did he tell them where and how to build a house? Because, in his case, he tells them right up front. 24. Everyone who hears these words of mine and what? Acts. Brethren, you're not here tonight, except you're an actor. Because you built on rock. You're doing something about what you hear. You're spectacular, you know. You're impressive. You're like a city built on a rock. You're like light. You're like salt. Because you're here. Because you're getting the job done. Now, I'm out of time, so I'm going to skip the last one. You can look up Luke 7 if you like on your own, but it's a long one, and so I'm going to pass on that. Thank you for your time. We're going to get deeper and deeper into these parables, and we're going to find that they can get fairly lengthy and quite complex and reveal or conceal life and death matters. Life and death. And I don't mean just spiritually and eternally. Life and death for those people in their time. It is a way to illuminate profoundly important truths, to help those truths mean more to you because you've spent time and money and effort, you know, to learn them, or sail right over your head at the worst conceivable cost because you didn't do what every one of you did tonight, put forth the extra effort to come, to think, to study, to learn. You're My Strength is our final song, again from the supplement, number 136. If you have a need of any kind to become a Christian washed in the blood of Christ, to study some thorny Bible passage, to wrestle with some problem that has been troubling you, then let it be known. Come speak with me, please, as we stand in this.